Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. My name is Sean Gallagher, and I appear this morning on behalf of Harrison Medical Center. I'm going to try to reserve at least 5 minutes for rebuttal. The issue before the Court today is whether a plaintiff who filed a False Claims Act claim to establish that she had committed no Medicare fraud is protected under the anti-retaliation provisions of the Act, even if there was no showing that such a claim would be viable. Here, Ms. Cook, concerned that she might have unknowingly committed Medicare fraud, was asked at trial what was the purpose in filing the QI-TAM claim. And she answered, to clear my name and my work history that I committed no Medicare fraud. There are two reasons why this Court should reverse the judgment in favor of Ms. Cook and remand the case for further proceedings. First, Ms. Cook cannot recover for blowing a whistle on herself because she lacks scienter. Second, Cook was not engaged in conduct that is protected under the False Claims Act. But first, Cook cannot recover for blowing a whistle on herself.
So, counsel, if yes, I could, your Honor. Time's ticking. Forgive me for interrupting, but of course, her brief says she wasn't, that that's not her theory, that she blew the whistle on herself. Her brief says that she blew the whistle on this manual. So, do you want to speak to that?
Yeah. First of all, corporations can only act in through their individuals. So obviously, the manual can't be a relator.
Yes. But in terms of, so what's wrong with? I mean, we're looking at this went to the jury. This isn't summary judgment.
Yes.
So
yes.
They and you're not challenging an instruction. The jury found that she subjectively and objectively had this belief.
Correct.
That false billings had been submitted. I guess. Is the theory was the idea that she noticed this discrepancy, or it was called to her attention, and she said she'd been following, very clear in her testimony, that she'd been following the manual. So why couldn't it be the theory that her suspicion was that something was up, that false, right, and that she'd been unwittingly a part of that scheme by following those directions? Why wouldn't that work? It would be unusual, but
it doesn't work because it's not a False Claims Act retaliation claim. It's probably a great public policy discharge claim, but it's not a False Claims Act retaliation claim. And the reason that it's not is because the False Claims Act requires that the underlying claim be viable, and that the plaintiff's belief, the would-be relator in that situation, that her belief be objectively reasonable.
It doesn't have, a false claim doesn't have to have been submitted, which you know because your brief is clear about
correct.
That. Viable, you argue a lot in your briefing that it was not reasonable for her to think this because,
yes.
Right? But Miyoki did testify that the
Gen Ed
software was used in generating a final billing, he said. It did generate the final billing. So, you know, sort of a step before, which is a little different than...
Well, a couple of reasons. First of all, you cannot be in the False Claims Act context both a relator and the fraudster. You can't be the person that performs the act that is supposedly illegal and then be the relator in the underlying False Claims Act claim to recover. And
that's the argument you make in your brief repeatedly, and I'm asking you to posit this a little differently. Why couldn't it be, because I'm not arguing that point with you,
certainly.
Why couldn't it be the case that this discrepancy was called to her attention and she testified pretty vaguely later in the trial that she thought somewhere in the system fraud could be happening and she may just have been seeing an indication of it?
Well, first of all, when she testified about John Miyake, she was absolutely clear about what she believed Mr. Miyake did and did not do.
She was asked, did you believe that he committed fraud? And she said she couldn't say one way or another. She didn't know.
Right, right. So there was no affirmative evidence that she thought he committed fraud.
Right. He doesn't have to be the one committing fraud. I think the difficulty I'm having is that when we're looking at subjective belief, we're looking at whether there could be a potential claim. And when you add potential claim to the standard of review, you get pretty far out there in terms of you having an uphill battle to overturn the verdict. So my concern is that the picture she's painting in her testimony is that she believed, given what she was starting to see, that there was something wrong in the system that was really the company's fault, not her fault, but that she was going to get tagged with it. may or may not be true, but why isn't that enough to be a subjective belief?
Well, Your Honor, remember that the test is really both subjective and objective.
Correct.
Certainly, if she says she had a reason to believe that there was a problem with the software, that's a subjective opinion that she had. And there certainly is record evidence that would support, you know, her testimony about her subjective belief. Mm-hmm. But that's only one of the two tests that have to be satisfied. It does have to be objectively reasonable. That's, you know, from the Haygood case and cases that cite it more and others. It's absolutely clear that the belief has to be objectively reasonable.
Weren't she told by Karen Holland and Diane Wasson that there are big problems here and it's fraudulent and maybe Medicare or Medicaid got overbilled?
Well, there is testimony that at the hearing that she, at the meeting that she had with Ms. Wasson mentioned that there was a concern about fraud. But again, I come back to the
here's what I think Diane Wasson said at that meeting. We've been working on some things. I don't think you've described them adequately, pointing at Ms. Cook. We're finding that there are big problems everywhere. They're very serious. I believe they are fraudulent. Why isn't that enough?
Because there was no record evidence at trial to tie that to a fraudulent submission to the government. What they were talking about were inaccuracies in internal reporting. There was no evidence at trial about how Harrison went about submitting claims to Medicare, whether any Medicare claims were in fact fraudulent. There was no evidence whatsoever to connect the operation of this GenEnd software with the submission of a claim.
And of course, there doesn't have to have been a false claim submitted, but she does have to have thought something was up. She has to have had a subjective and a reasonably objective suspicion, at least, right? My understanding of the chronology is part of the problem. This discrepancy was called to the plaintiff's attention. The plaintiff was asked to investigate rather than following up on her own hunch, right? She's and then reports back and realizes she's generating the report daily, and that was a mistake. Testimony is very clear she never had any fraudulent intent, right?
Jury clearly
agreed with that. And then upon her report to the supervisors, the next morning that you get to the point Judge Hawkins is describing where her supervisor's reaction clearly seems to me frightened her, that they suspected fraud, right?
Well,
is that part of the problem? I mean, at that point, it seems like it was reasonable for her to be frightened that there may have been fraud somewhere afoot.
Right, but remember, that was after the initial contact the initial discussion she had with Ms. Wasson. There's no testimony that there was any discussion of fraud. Then she went out and she called the helpline, the McKesson helpline, and then she came back and reported to Ms. Wasson in her testimony. Wasson denied that, but obviously we're here before the court on the record in a light most favorable to the plaintiff. The plaintiff at that point testifies that Ms. Wasson mentioned fraud. Now, the court's absolutely correct. That may well satisfy the subjective standard. We're not suggesting that Ms. Cook was lying about what she felt. Certainly there's record evidence to support that there was a subjective belief. It's the objective component, too. Remember, it's a two-part test. And an objective person, remember, Ms. Cook had 37 years of experience as a medical billing specialist. She was in management for 11 years. A person in that position could not reasonably have believed that she had a viable False Claims Act claim because she would be both the relator and the fraudster. But more important, she lacked this requisite scienter. In order to bring a fraud claim, you have to act knowingly.
Not if she thinks, that's why she's saying that she didn't commit fraud, right? But that she thought, I think the theory is that she stumbled into it, right? That she, and hence the question, did you think that your predecessor who wrote this manual that you were following, did you think he had fraudulent intent?
And she said she didn't know.
She said she doesn't know.
I mean,
was she ever asked counsel whether she suspected anybody else?
Yes, and her testimony was that she did not.
Do you have the ER site for that?
Yeah, I will. Yeah.
Or the transcript site.
Yeah, 202, ER 202,
okay.
Lines 13 to 16. She cannot identify anyone at Harrison that she thinks intentionally committed Medicare fraud.
Was she ever asked directly whether she thought false claims were submitted, that it actually happened?
I don't know, Your Honor. We could check the record and supply a...
You know, I guess that's what struck me on both sides is the, you know, $100 million questions were never asked by either side that would pinpoint. I mean, I'm looking at this. They ask, well, did you think, you know, Mr. Miyake or whomever committed fraud? No, I couldn't say one way or the other. But that doesn't really answer any questions. So when you're looking at what the elements are, I was just struck that neither side really pinpointed and asked those questions that were critical to the defense or the claim.
Your Honor, I see that I'm running low on time.
If I could briefly answer that question and then save some time. And maybe they're there and I didn't see them, but I was combing the record.
Well, I think the passage that you're referring to, which is in the record at 203 lines 2 to 9, mm-hmm. she's absolutely clear. She does not know whether Mr. Miyake committed fraud. Now, remember, the plaintiffs bear the burden of proof here.
Right, but we don't
and there's
need...
No,
see, that's okay. A piece of evidence, but it doesn't tell you the whole story. And so then I was curious why in your Rule 50 motions you focused almost primarily on her subjective belief.
Well, it's because...
And yet not what you're now arguing as being the key issue, which is the objective belief.
And one simple reason, Your Honor, that we had already moved under Rule 56, the motion for summary judgment, on that ground, and the judge had denied that motion. You know, in the Rule 50 motion, first of all, we're not required to raise every issue that we had previously raised on summary judgment. You basically pick which arrows in your quiver you think are going to have the best shot, and the argument that the court just articulated had been raised and shot down on summary judgment. So
that was before trials.
Right. But still, it was a legal issue.
You want to save the remaining
You're
time?
Right. I would like to save the remaining
time. I have a quick
time.
Question before you
certainly.
Do. My understanding is that Ms. Cook was compiling this report daily, and at the end of the day, it turned out it should have been done monthly.
That's correct.
Could compiling it monthly have resulted in inaccurate information given the government?
There was testimony.
Yes or no?
No, it could not.
Thank you.
Right. I'd like to reserve the remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Dan Weiskopf. With me at council tables, Teresa DeMonte. We represent the appellee, Lori Cook.
Counsel, can you tell me what your theory was at trial? Where's the evidence that supports the elements going to fraud?
Sure. So the theory, I was not trial counsel, but it was not that she was blowing the whistle on herself. Ms.
Right.
Cook testified
Got
repeatedly.
That. Your brief is clear on that. And it says she was blowing the whistle on the manual. What does that mean?
So she was blowing the whistle. She found, information during this investigation that there were a number of elements going, there were a number of factors going into what she discovered. And if I could just give a 30 seconds of context, I think that would be helpful. A new finance director comes in to Harrison.
Yes.
Suddenly, the books don't add up. Everyone's very concerned. There's a report showing overbilling on a Medicare report. Ms. Cook is told to investigate this. She investigates
right.
this. And she discovers this manual that it's an in-house manual, which means they didn't just it's an off-the-shelf package, and they have an in-house manual that
Brief
says
is clear on this point.
Yes.
And she's following the directions, and she's adamant she followed the directions to the letter, and the manual disappears, and we've all read the brief.
Right.
So what's your theory?
So the theory is, yeah, she did not, and I agree with, there was no testimony on who did it and who's responsible, the who, what, when, where of fraud was not testified to. It's not in the record. But she doesn't need to have that. All she needs to have is a reasonable belief. And so...
That fraud was actually committed. She has to think it's really happening.
Right.
So what did she think? Where is it
Possibly
on the record?
Possibly happening.
And again, okay, so there was no fraud. I mean, at the end of the day, there will not be proof of, and I apologize if I'm not answering the question, but there will not be proof of fraud. I mean, she can speculate after the fact.
But what was her theory that she had a hunch about what was happening? She has to have had a legitimate good faith belief that and fill in that blank for me.
That the company was somehow, that someone was skimming off the top, that it could have been Miyoki, it could have been someone else, that she was getting instructions to bill a certain way, that those were affecting final claims, and that there was money that was getting.
Even though she was in a position to know, and she testified very clearly that she knew that that software didn't generate a bill that was submitted to the government.
She did not. The testimony on this is that she believed, and this is at ER 240, when you pressed the GenN function key or radio button, did it appear to affect revenue? Yes. No one told you differently, right? So she did not, and there's more along those lines. Miyoki had said that GenN could lead to a final claim. She didn't know. She didn't know how GenN affected things. All she knew is she's pressing a button called affect revenue. She's being instructed to do it the wrong way by the company, and that there's this missing money, and this new finance director who's coming in and saying there's missing money. And the reasonable belief standard, I mean, it's not even a reasonable belief of fraud. It's a reasonable belief that they could be committing fraud. I mean, the jury would have had to find that
who would be doing it?
And again, it would be, perhaps it was Diane Wasson, perhaps it was Miyoki, perhaps it was someone else at the company.
What she testified is, when you were concerned with fraud, did it reflect the whole department or just, not just you personally? And she said it would reflect the whole department.
Right.
So we don't know.
And she doesn't have to know. The case law is incredibly clear, at least from my perspective, that and especially under the new FIRA 2009 amendments, any act is protected. She does not, you can't expect someone or want to have a policy where someone, you can fire them quickly before they figure out the fraud and you're off the hook before they understand it. They don't have to put together the pieces. All they have to do is reasonably believe that what they're doing is to help stop fraud. Reckless billing is also part of the scienter. And this could clearly, I mean, the theory could also be that this was reckless billing, that there was no reasonable steps taken to make sure that the claims were accurate. And so all she has to believe is that she is working towards that goal and that she tells her employer that she's working towards that.
Let's assume you've satisfied that. What's the proof of that it was objectively reasonable?
That it was objectively reasonable. Sure. And again, objective reasonableness is it's a constellation of facts. It looks at her experience. It looks at a whole lot of different things. And it's ultimately trying to get into her mind, and it's a jury question.
You agree with your opponent that it made no difference in terms of the accuracy of information going to the government, whether this report was done daily or monthly.
I believe that's the record shows that there was an investigation done by McKesson and that they determined that
there are yes or no in there somewhere.
I agree that there was no fraudulent billing.
And that was the concern at the end of the day, that she had been compiling it daily instead of monthly.
That's correct. But
at the time she was doing this, no one knew whether the daily was going to skew the report. Is
exactly.
Right?
Nobody knew. So she did not put together all the pieces of the fraud. She did not understand the who, when, where, when. All she did is she said, this is concerning. We can't add up the books. She went, she found something saying, do this the wrong way on affect revenue, pressing affect revenue. And she believed that she could be causing the government to be mismilled and that she could be doing it because it was something that
I would feel a lot better if she said that. Can you point on page, isn't this your client's testimony on page 195 where she says the gen end is just an internal process? Where does she say all of what you just said about believing that this could be affecting the final process?
Sure,
she had that belief.
ER 240
okay.
is, I believe, our best site on that.
Okay, thank you.
And it says, when you press the GenN function key or radio button, did it appear to affect revenue? And she said, yes. No one told you definitely right. And so that was what she was operating under. And I think that the other piece of evidence, the jury's supposed to figure out what would a reasonable person in her shoes believe, and that no person, reasonable person, could believe that this was fraud. But we don't have to guess at what another reasonable employee in her situation would have thought, because we have Ms. Wasson's testimony.
Ms. Wasson's testimony.
Right.
Yes, another, but I'm looking for your client's testimony.
Oh, right. But another employee, are we talking about reasonable belief? Another employee looked at these same facts, and said, there's fraud here. And ER 333 to 34, I think, is just very key testimony of Ms. Wasson's, where she describes the conversation with Lori Cook. And she says that when Lori Cook brought this information to Ms. Wasson, it was a revelation. And actually, there's a typo in there that says revolution twice, but it's got to mean revelation. It says that this was a revelation, that every account balance has been misrepresented. So Ms. Wasson, when she got this information, said every account balance has been misrepresented. And her counsel said, what do you mean it's been misrepresented? Which account? She said every one was misrepresented during this time period. And Ms. Wasson's notes at ER 494 mirror this testimony. So, and then Ms. Wasson goes and gets a fraud investigation, gets an external McKesson to come in and do a fraud investigation, says, I confirm it appears that there's fraud here. And so another person looked at this and had the exact same reaction as Ms. Cook. And so I think that is evidence and there's cases to support that is evidence that the jury can consider. In terms of some of the questions about who was committing the fraud and can you blow the whistle on yourself, the analogy I think of is if a store is rigging the scale so the clerk is pressing weigh and it's a pound of bananas is actually getting weighed at a 1.1 and they're charging people, the clerk doesn't know when they press weigh that they're committing fraud, but, you know, the store is committing the fraud. The clerk is just the unwitting cog in the fraudulent machine.
Counsel, you submitted a 28J letter that goes to the notion that there's now authority in a different circuit that it's possible to blow the whistle on yourself. Is that your theory or not? Are you changing your theory? What am I to do with that 28J letter?
Oh, no. That was not supposed to change the theory at all. That was just saying that even if you were a knowing participant, the blanket rule put forward by the appellant that you can never be a part of a fraud and blow the whistle on yourself, you can be part of something.
But that wasn't your theory?
But that was not, no.
And it's not your theory today?
No, she had absolutely was not a part of this. She was, to the extent that there wasn't any fraud at the end of the day, but to the extent that she believed anything was going wrong, she testified repeatedly. She had no intent to commit fraud, and she was just following the instructions to a T. I can continue with my argument unless there's further questions.
It's a very unusual case with respect to the False Claims Act, particularly with the timing. So everything's compressed into one day. Does it matter what happened that day and the next day? Does it matter anything that happened after those 2 days?
I would submit no. I mean, for atmospherics, it would change things. But in terms of the protected conduct, all the False Claims Act, and again, 3729 and 3730H, the two statutes, and this is something where I think it gets mixed up in the briefing of appellants. 3729 is the relator bringing forward a fraud claim. There you need to prove up fraud. You need to prove scienter. 3730H, you just have the reasonableness standard. 3730H protects the investigation. It doesn't protect against fraud. And so, and it protects all ranges of investigation. I mean, just as long as you're turning over a rock and with the thought that you're going after fraud and then the next rock and the next rock.
Does it matter that your client wasn't doing that? I mean, her testimony is not that she had a hunch and she was following up and her hunch is that someone else called this to her attention, as Judge McKeown said, in one day. Over the course of one day, she was directed to go follow up, and she talked with Tiffany on the helpline several times and then reported those results back, as opposed to the typical, much more typical whistleblower who thinks he or she might be on to something. Does that matter?
I don't think that there's any case law or policy reason why you would, if you say to an employee, go figure out what's going on here, the employee comes back and says, I've got it. It's fraud. I figured it out. And they say, you're fired.
Well, your client didn't say that. Your client did not come back and say, I've got it. It's fraud.
Correct. But I'm just saying, well, she came back and said, and I agree that the testimony is a little.
Came back and said, I made a mistake. And she's clear she never had fraudulent intent.
No,
I've been mistakenly running this every day. Tiffany's explained this to me.
She did not, according to our testimony, this side's testimony, she did not say, I made a mistake. She said, I've been doing everything exactly accurately. Harrison has been instructing me to do things this way.
Okay, but why is that different in the context of what we're talking about here? She's adamant she had no fraudulent intent. She was following the instructions on the screenshots. Again, you know, we read the briefing. doing exactly what she was told, and she realizes Tiffany has told her now, oops, that's a mistake. The report is intended to be run monthly.
Because she thought that she
had... So how does that change your answer?
Because she thought she had discovered potential false claim. And she doesn't have to use the word fraud or...
Okay, so her theory really was that what she was doing was incorrect. That was the problem. Not that somebody else somewhere in the system was monkeying with the process?
No, her theory was that somewhere in the system, and she doesn't know the who, what, where, when, why, and she doesn't have to, but at some point someone created a system which had her pressing effect revenue too frequently, billing in the wrong way, and this is in the context of there's missing money and we're trying to figure out why it says there's this overcharge report for Medicare.
At the end of the day, if an employee, this is hypothetical, points to a problem that they believe could involve fraud, and an honest investigation is done, this is hypothetical, and the conclusion of the investigation is there's nothing fraudulent, but your employee is incompetent, and the employee gets fired for lack of competence, how can that fit within the FCA?
And that is the case that Harrison put on at trial. They put on this case about she was a terrible employee despite all of her good reviews. They said that she messed this up, that there was this, the manual was mistaken.
Let's just assume in my hypothetical this is a perfectly good employee. The employee comes to supervisors and says, I think there's a problem here and it may be resulting in inaccurate information going to the government. Fine, we'll look into it. They look into it, they conclude there's no problem with the processes. The problem is the competence of the employee.
Correct.
That's a fraud FCA claim?
If the employee thought that they were investigating fraud and the company knew that they were investigating fraud or something along, you know, an FCA claim, and they fired them for that investigation, that would fall within the False Claims Act.
Is there any evidence in this record that would contradict the reasons the company discharged her?
She had excellent...
Namely, reviews. That she didn't process this information correctly, competently.
So, and I might not be fully understanding your question. I hope I can address it. She had excellent employee reviews forever. She investigated this material. She went to Diane Wasson. Diane Wasson said, yes, there's fraud here. I agree. And then the next morning, she's suspended.
You know, if this is wrongful discharge, I've got no problem with that.
Counsel, in response to Judge Hawkins' question, you just said an important thing, I think. You said if she thought she was investigating fraud, and my understanding is that she didn't think that or have reason to think that until she reported back to Diane Wasson, who reacted very dramatically.
And again, she doesn't need to – she doesn't have to be thinking the F word of fraud. She just needs to be thinking that there is some possibility that the government is getting charged.
Okay, where's the record that she thought in the course of that one-day period before the meeting where she reported back – where is an indication that she thought that might have been something fraudulent afoot?
ER 155.
And that tells me that when did she have that thought?
Going back to when you were asked to investigate both the monthly credit report and the McKesson overpayment report issues, did you believe they had fraud potential? Yes, I believe they would have fraud potential. And ER 423, where she testifies that the first meeting on November 6th, she thought that there was a fraud implication.
And is the first meeting on November 6th?
Yes, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Sorry, and that's the meeting between whom and whom?
That's when Wasson goes to Cook and says,
go do this.
We got a problem, we got to figure this out.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time.
I want to begin with addressing the question, Judge Hawkins, that you posed. And I think one of the things that the court is struggling with here is that the plaintiffs might have presented a very strong case for public policy discharge or some sort of other wrongful discharge claim under state law. But that was never pled. What was pled was a False Claims Act claim. And I would suggest that stretching the False Claims Act to cover areas that would be otherwise covered by state law claims is starting this court down a very slippery slope. Because essentially, if the plaintiff wins in this case, depending on how the opinion is constructed, it could mean that employers are faced with a very, very difficult situation, faced with a situation in which if an employee subjectively believes that they've got a fraud claim, regardless of whether there's any reasonable basis for that, employers have to be concerned about dealing with those kinds of issues.
You do have to meet the second prong, and that's the objective prong.
Yes.
So if both of those are met, you may well have a state law and a federal law claim.
If both of those are met, you may. And our position is obviously that both are not met, that there is no objective basis. And it's because of scienter. Now, I want to point the court back to the focus on what was Ms. Cook investigating. The salient testimony is at page 202 in the record, page 149, page 223, 224, and 225. It is absolutely clear from the record that Ms. Cook was investigating her own conduct. She was investigating whether she may have unknowingly committed fraud. She filed the False Claims Act claim, she testified on page 223, to clear her name. She asked the Department of Justice to investigate to determine to clear her name. That's on page 224. On page 427, she said what was your concern? Her concern was that she may have committed fraud. I see I'm out of time. If I may be allowed just perhaps two more minutes to complete my rebuttal.
You can sum up, yes.
Okay.
Sum up, but don't repeat.
That's the challenge, and I will do that. This is a case in which the plaintiff has simply failed to establish the requisite elements of scienter. We would suggest that the court, as it has done, look very closely at the record, very closely at what her testimony is, and that the court reverse the judgment of the district court and remand it for proceedings under Rule 60B-5 to address the award of attorney's fees. If there are no further questions, I thank the court.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank both counsel for your argument today. The case of Cook versus Harrison Medical is submitted.